Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name is Craig Forces. I'm here with Stephanie Carvin. We're in the inner suburbs of Ottawa today. And in fact, we got together because we wanted to talk about this breaking issue or series of issues involving the chemical weapons use on British territory.
I mean, normally we talk about issues as they only specifically relate to Canada. We're being a little bit more broad in our thinking today, but I think we're both kind of fascinated by this.
And horrified.
Yeah, and horrified, and what the actual implications are for international law.
So what we're going to do is we're going to walk through this issue and talk mainly about the international law issues, not so much the UK law issues, but the international law issues. And that'll comprise the special podcast, because tomorrow we will also post our regular podcast, which deals with updates in matters Canadian. And so let's turn, Stephanie, to the topic that's on everyone's minds these days, at least in our area of the world, which is this extraordinary series of events in Salisbury, England. The use of a nerve agent, a very particular nerve agent, and an attempted assassination of Sergia and Julia Skrepal. Sergia Skrepal being the individual who was a Russian military intelligence officer and ultimately ended up working for the British and has, for the last two decades or so, been living in the UK, was discovered suffering from palpitations and along with his daughter in Salisbury, diagnosed with exposure to a nerve agent. We also have a police officer who is still in serious condition, the first officer to appear on the scene, and a number of other people, as many as what I saw, depending on who media outlook, something like two dozen persons who may have been exposed, warnings from the UK government to wipe down your cell phones and wash your clothes if you were in the region. This is an absolutely remarkable event. And so we wanted to talk a little bit about the law and policy issues that stem from this, even though it's not a Canadian story. It's nevertheless so notorious that it's worth some inquiry on our podcast.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. But, you know, if not to jump the gun, but if one of the speculations is that the UK could actually look at a NATO Article 4. Article 4 is where you actually just bring an issue to the attention of the North Atlantic Council.
Right, okay.
So actually, you know, Canada could be involved if NATO, whether it's, so it's short of Article 5, but...
Article 5, for reasons we'll discuss, doesn't fit.
No, but they could definitely potentially consider Article 4, but we'll get there in a second. So I think, you know, Britain's one of our major allies. It's really important. The only thing I would add, though, is that in some ways this is extraordinary, but in other ways we have seen so many Russians die mysterious deaths in the UK.
Yeah. 14 cases being reopened by the British.
Right.
And that's in addition to the Litvinenko case, which, of course, was notorious because of the use of polonium.
Yeah. And which actually, it was at the Millennium Hotel, which, if anyone's familiar with the UK, was right outside McDonald House, which is formerly a Canadian High Commission building. Right. So there was a lot of Canadians that were very worried that they, too, had been exposed to polonium. These attacks, you know, they're targeted, but they're not necessarily discriminate.
Well, and the other thing, too, is so in the Litvinenko matter, there was an inquiry in the United Kingdom and issued its report in 2016 and did attribute, based on the evidence and analysis before Sir Robert Owen, who was the leader of that inquiry, attribute the orders in terms of the assassination of Mr. Litvinenko to Mr. Putin,
right,
and the FSB.
Yeah.
So there was a clear indication of attribution. At least there was evidence of attribution, in part because of the notoriety of the substance used in the assassination. Right, this was not a knifing in the back alley. This was the use of a very rare substance in the possession whose signature could be traced very, very clearly to its origin.
Right, this is not something you're picking up at like Shoppers Drug Mart.
Right, and so too for this latest instance. Right, because
yeah,
that issue in terms of the assassination attempt. This most recent assassination attempt is this nerve agent called Novichok, which is itself notorious. We'll talk about it in a second. It's more lethal even than sarin and VX in terms of being a nerve agent, and it is attributable to the Russians, right? And so, to the extent that its chemical signature can be tied to the Russians, and we know about it in part because a Russian scientist revealed that the Russians were developing this substance in 1992.
Even when they were supposed to have disarmed.
Right, in part to duck the obligations of the Chemical Weapons Convention, which was signed in 1993 and came into effect in 1997. And it's notorious, Novichok, because it can be built from precursors that themselves are commonplace, and pesticide products and the like. And so it could duck, in other words, the sort of inquiry and investigation associated with the Chemical Weapons Convention because the precursors were so innocuous. And so one of the issues here is that Russians, if they're using these substances, they are not camouflaging their activity. This is a transparent message, not just to the person who was the target, but to other dissidents.
I think it's a really important aspect of this. It's, yeah, there's clearly a message. You know, if you want to get someone, you like, you know, there's much more subtle ways to get someone than with a Cold War era chemical weapon that is four times more deadly than...
Indiscriminate.
Nerve agent, right.
So I guess there are a couple of things that we need to talk about legally, because one of the other things that's come up is the Prime Minister of Britain, Ms. May, yesterday in the House of Commons in the United Kingdom, said that insofar as the British government is concerned, this was a use of force, right? And so that sparked all sorts of discussions.
It's interesting language.
Interesting language, because this is doctrinal language, right? And so it's worth contemplating what it means, practically speaking, in terms of international law, and also then the remedies that are available to the UK, because people have skated very quickly from that to, well, that's the beginning then of a retaliatory use of force by the United Kingdom. Of course, we're not there yet by any measure. But let's, so I think we need to unpack some of the international law issues. Do you want me just to take an initial stab at this?
Yeah, the only thing I would say to this is that Putin, just quickly, Putin has now, or Russia has now said that they're not going to respond.
Yeah, okay. So that was breaking news
as of this morning. Yeah. So God knows where we're going to be in 8 hours, but there you go.
And on Twitter, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs is deriding the UK and generally making comments that
which is just
frankly
gross.
Are unhelpful.
Yeah.
So the first step in any kind of analysis here is always going to be one of attribution. And so can you, in fact, attribute this conduct to a state? In this case, of course, the most likely state is Russia. Now, of course, if it was done by a state organ, that's plain and simple, that it would be attributable to the Russian state, even if that state organ, by the way, exceeded its authority or contravened its instructions. And so if there's some rogue element within the Russian security apparatus that engaged in this activity.
Which is possible, although
even more frightening at the idea that there's some rogue element that's running around using chemical weapons.
But this was the conclusion of Arkady Ostrovsky, who's the Economist editor for Russia. And he basically said the only thing worse than Putin ordering this is that he didn't. So, you know, and he reminds us, I think usefully, that, you know, it's not just Putin. He isn't some kind of mastermind that controls every single thing. There's a network of the state security apparatus and criminals around him that he depends on for his power. Right.
And the idea that they would have access to this chemical weapon is terrifying.
Yeah.
Because who else might have access in a regime that is notorious for its corruption?
Right.
So this raises the issue as to whether terrorists would have their hands on chemical weapons, which of course has been in the crosshairs of concern since 9/11, if not before. But even if the state organs didn't conduct this activity, if the person who did was acting under the instructions or direction or control of the state in carrying out the conduct, that too results in attribution to the state. So at the end of the day, that's a question of fact, and we don't have all the facts, but the very nature of this weapon, this chemical weapon, does tend to point to Russia. And so we'll, for the sake of the rest of the argument here, we'll presume that the attribution will be satisfied. And we're talking, as apparently was the case with Litvinenko, we'll talk about something that was directed by Russia. Now, so an assassination attempt. So what's that mean legally? Well, you know, the polite way of discussing an assassination attempt is targeted killings, right? And so targeted killings are now sadly reasonably commonplace. I'm actually reading the book on the Israeli history of targeted killings, which is absolutely fascinating. Big, long book, and I hadn't appreciated the depth and legacy of targeted killings in the Israeli context. Also targeted killings, we call that droning, right? But it's a form of targeted killings that's been deployed by other states, including the United Kingdom itself, since 9/11. It's not always illegal. We've had this conversation before when we talked about the Canadian government's reaction to the idea that there might be targeted killings in the Syrian-Iraqi context in one of our earlier podcasts.
Yeah.
And so in an armed conflict situation, it is absolutely legal to use lethal force against another combatant, subject to certain prohibitions. But you can kill people in an armed conflict. And so if this were an armed conflict, the conversation would be very different. But yes, we're not talking about an armed conflict.
We are not.
There is no armed conflict in Salisbury, right? Nor is the United Kingdom and Russia in a situation of armed conflict. And so the conversation really has to be about other principles of international law, which are much more constraining on the use of lethal force. And so for one thing, it seems unambiguous that if Russia were behind this, it would be a clear violation of UK sovereignty and the exercise of unlawful extraterritorial enforcement jurisdiction on UK territory. And we've had that conversation a couple of podcasts ago when we talked about cyber. and cyber attacks. There's also the prospect of Russia violating its human rights obligations. And there the conversation is more complex, but Russia is a party to both the European Convention on Human Rights and also the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, both of which protect a right to life. The issue then is whether that obligation extends beyond Russian territory. And both the European Convention and the ICCPR, the International Covenant, are extraterritorial in their reach, at least in circumstances where the victim is within the effective control of the state. And so that would be an interesting question as to whether you could say that the victim in this case was within the effective control of the assassin. There is a view, and this is a view that's come up in the context of drone strikes, where if you're shooting someone with a Hellfire missile from, you know, a high altitude drone, it's hard to say that that person is truly within your effective control in the same way as they would be if they were in custody. But there is,
pardon my ignorance, is the ICC, the ICCPR and the ECHR, are there criminal grounds
to prosecute? So that's issue. It. They create state responsibility, but they don't create individual culpability.
Right.
And so we'd be talking about Russia being responsible as a state, but not necessarily the individuals being criminally culpable, at least under these instruments. They would be criminally culpable under domestic British law, obviously, but
it's murder.
Because it's murder, right? And so at issue then would be whether you could ever extradite them and try them in front of British courts. But just to refer back to this issue of extraterritoriality, at least in relation to drones, the UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial and Arbitrary Executions has said, look, there's a generic customary international human rights norm that says that countries are bound to ensure the realization of the right to life when they use force, whether inside or outside their borders. So regardless of the reach of these particular treaties. Now, that's not every state's going to agree with that, but there is at least a plausible argument that what Russia did here violated its human rights obligations for what it's worth, right? Because then you run into the problem of what venue are you going to take them to. There's more prospect of a remedy under the European Convention, because there's a remedy system there, whether Russia would ever be dragged into the court. And Russia's been making noises about withdrawing from the European Convention on Human Rights anyway. So,
could you set up a lawsuit?
Well, so that's it, right? So the question is whether you could find a venue. And it's always very hard because states generally will not accept the jurisdiction of international tribunals. There's more prospect of that under the European Convention than there would be under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights.
Right.
But the bottom line is we've got at least two breaches so far of international law, sovereignty and human rights. Mm-hmm. Then we get to the vector, the nerve agent, right? And that's what makes this quite unique as compared to, say, other instances of targeted killings, because in most other instances, how you kill them doesn't matter. It doesn't add sort of a supplemental international wrong. When you're using a chemical weapon, that's different. Why? Because under the Chemical Weapons Convention, this 1997 instrument, in fact, all parties, Russia's one, are prohibited from using chemical weapons on top of stockpiling and making them. And so right away, you have to wonder whether Russia has been compliant with its obligation not to develop, produce, or otherwise stockpile chemical weapons. And then certainly there's been a use of a chemical weapon here. And so, in fact, the British representative to the organization under the Chemical Weapons Convention that's charged with conducting its compliance reviews appeared today, as I understand it, in front of that body and said, it's remarkable that I'm coming before you for the first time since the Second World War to accuse another state of using a chemical agent in a European country. Right. And so at issue there would be whether Russia's also in violation of its obligations under the Chemical Weapons Convention. All these things put together means there's a lot of things that Russia did wrong before we even get to a conversation about use of force. So the issue is then what remedies would be available? And this actually also alludes back to our conversation last day about cyber. Because at issue here would be countermeasures, almost certainly. And so countermeasures are available where a state breaches international law obligations. The victim state can suspend, at least on a proportional basis, the international law obligations it owes the wronging state and take action that would otherwise be unlawful in international law. There are some constraints. Countermeasures are not an excuse to use force that's otherwise illicit, nor is it an excuse to violate diplomatic immunities, nor is it an excuse to violate human rights. So you couldn't say, well, we're going to retaliate by killing one of your Russians. I mean, that just doesn't work. But
that's just it. Like, I think there's this perception of deterrence and all these things where it's like you have to respond like for like. And that's not the way any of this works.
No, it doesn't have to be like for like, but it has to be proportional. So,
yes.
I'm going to suspend all flights from Moscow to Britain that might otherwise violate treaties involving aeronautics. Is that a proportionate countermeasure? Well, possibly, right? Now, there's some tricky aspects here in the sense that the countermeasure has to be directed at ensuring compliance with the international law norm that's been violated. And so it's a one-off. What would compliance look like? Does it mean that that the noncompliance continues to persist so long as Russia doesn't actually provide a remedy. All right, so these are sort of these tricky, nuanced legal issues. But I think the door to countermeasures is at least open reasonably wide. And one of the issues, incidentally, for the UK in the wake of the Litvinenko case, for instance, a lot of people said the UK response wasn't forceful enough and that the Russians took from that the UK is weak and that they wouldn't actually act in a meaningful way. And so at issue for the UK now is whether they're credibly going to offer up some sort of countermeasure or response to this latest incident.
And that's going to be hard because right now you're dealing with the U.S. president who frankly is sympathetic to Russia, as well as, you know, the UK does not have the best relations with the European Union now. Now, it is interesting that I did notice, and it's just a little bit of an aside, that the head negotiator for Brexit from the EU actually expressed his strong support of the UK in this and said that Europe will stand with
them. I'd be hard-pressed to believe that Brexit issue will interfere with a European...
Not the Brexit issue, but it's interesting because traditionally, I mean, the Europeans have taken a softer approach to Russia when these kinds of things have happened in the past, right? So countries like Germany and France, for example, have sometimes argued for a more softer approach to Russia. So it's going to be really interesting to see what their approach is here.
Right. So can I just add one more thing?
Sure, there's a lot here.
So right away, people started talking about, well, this was a use of force on the territory of the United Kingdom, and therefore the United Kingdom can retaliate with use of force. No. This is a much more complex analysis. So the first observation is that, yes, Article 2, Sub 4 of the UN Charter prohibits use of force on the territory of another state or contrary to its political independence or otherwise in noncompliance with the UN. And so the issue is, what is a use of force? Now, Ms. May, in her declaration in Parliament yesterday, indicated that in the view of the United Kingdom government, this was a use of force. There is, however, a debate as to whether there's a de minimis standard for use of force. And so take, for example, the inquiry into use of force in Georgia that took the European inquiry into use of force. So this was the European Union's independent international fact-finding mission on the conflict in Georgia. In a footnote, without any support, I have to say, it suggested that some military incidents could fall below the threshold on use of force, and they used as an example the targeted killing of single individuals.
Interesting.
Forcible abduction of individual persons or the interception of a single aircraft. So they take the view that there's a de minimis threshold below which it's not a use of force. I think the better view is that if there is a de minimis threshold, it's a really de minimis threshold. And so there is, I think, probably the majority view amongst scholars in this area is that there's no specific gravity threshold for Article 2, Sub 4. And so Tom Roos, who's a scholar in this area, has said whenever one state deliberately sends military or police forces into the territory of another state without authorization from that state to take forcible action, that's enough for 2, Sub 4. I'm not sure if I would go that far, but given what happened on the ground in Salisbury, right, in terms of the consequences, we're talking not just about two individuals, but a police officer, and then the potentially indiscriminate spread of this agent to affect others, I'm reasonably content that this could be called a use of force. I'm not going to rush there, but I think it's reasonable to say that this was a use of force.
And could you, I mean, but also like if the UK was, and I don't think we're there yet, but you know, we mentioned kind of at the beginning of this that this isn't just a single case, that this has really been going on since 2006,
right.
And there's been all these different cases. So, I mean,
it's cumulative?
Cumulative.
Yeah. So, actually, you know, that I think you could make that argument. I think that might also bolster the supplemental discussion you have to have. And that is whether, on top of being a use of force, this is also an armed attack. So, why does that matter? Because Article 51 of the UN Charter, which recognizes the inherent right of self-defense, posits that right of self-defense is exercisable in circumstances where an armed attack occurs.
Right.
And so the issue is whether armed attack under Article 51 is the same thing as a use of force under Article 2, Sub 4. There are states that say that these are indistinguishable. So the United States takes that view, for instance. Most people take the view, and I'm of this school, that says that there is a distinction between use of force and armed attack. And so, for example, in the Nicaragua case, the International Court of Justice said that basically an armed attack is a really bad use of force. And so there is a threshold for armed attack that's different for a use of force. And so the issue is, have we actually gravitated beyond the level of a mere use of force to an armed attack, which then opens the door to the United Kingdom exercising its inherent right of self-defense? And there, I think there's more reason to doubt. And so one view is that to be an armed attack, there has to be considerable loss of life and extensive destruction of property, and we're not there yet. On the other hand, there are instances where states have looked at the accumulation of pinprick incidences to say, look, collectively that constitutes an armed attack to which then we're entitled to use force in response and self-defense. And Exhibit A is actually the use of force in the United Kingdom by, or not in the United Kingdom, but by the United Kingdom in 2015, the targeted killing of Rehad Khan by
Paddy John, by a
Reaper drone, RAF Reaper drone in Syria. There, the United Kingdom government argued that the fact that these individuals, Rehad Khan, had been implicated in a number of foiled terrorist incidences in the United Kingdom, collectively that was enough to constitute the threshold for armed attack. Now, that was a contested conclusion, but it was the position the United Kingdom took. And so there is the prospect, if you go back and you look at the Russian pattern of 14, people are saying as many as 14.
We don't know. They have to investigate.
Right? Yeah. They have to investigate. But perhaps these things could be daisy-chained together, and you say cumulatively there's an armed attack. I'm not content with that, I think, because I'm suspicious of the idea of using these pinpricks and saying cumulatively they constitute an armed attack, because it reduces the threshold and opens the door to more ready uses of force in international relations, which generally is something that should be discouraged. One last point, though. Even if it is an armed attack, the question is, what can you do in response?
Right.
Because even if you have a right to self-defense, the scope of that right to self-defense is constrained, right? This is an open invitation for people to get my book on the Caroline incident, which is the which is considered the locus classicus of
to be at all fine good bookstores.
Right. So this is the incident on the Niagara River in 1837, which is widely regarded as sort of constituting the index case in understanding the scope of the inherent right of self-defense. And so the classic ingredients are imminence, the imminence of the armed attack. Here you would argue that it's already occurred.
Yep.
But there's also a necessity and proportionality requirement. And there, I think the real issue would be necessity.
Yeah.
Because
you got to stop it.
Yeah, right. The whole purpose of self-defense is to stave off an armed attack as it's occurring. If this is a one-off or something that's come and gone, any forceful response at this point is not self-defense, rather it's a reprisal.
Mm.
And reprisals are unlawful in international law.
Yep.
And so you might be able to fiddle with that and say, well, this is part of an ongoing series of conduct by the Russians, and therefore this armed attack occurs. But once again, we have to be very suspicious of the daisy chaining of these incidences and saying that collectively they amount to a persistent armed attack, because you could do that quite easily with a lot of different instances and open the door wide to military use of force in the international relations environment on a more ready basis. And I think that has to be discouraged.
Yeah, I don't see a military response here per se. As we said, when I mentioned the NATO Article 4, it says the parties will consult together whenever, in the opinion of any of them, the territorial integrity, political independence, or security of any of the parties is threatened.
Right.
Right? So it's an important international forum where the Brits can basically make their case and to their allies as well as, you know, their other partners around the world. The interesting thing for me is, of course, you know, I lived in the UK for a decade. There's a lot of Russians there.
Right.
And there are a lot of Russians who've parked a lot of money there, some of whom almost certainly have ties to Putin. So are the Brits allowed to basically throw some sanctions on and target the individuals around Putin if they can't retaliate?
Right. So
specifically sanctions,
which in many cases won't implicate international law at all and so are freely available to the British, or where there might be an international law issue in play, it could fall within the range of that countermeasure concept we talked about before.
Right.
And so the other prospect is, I also read an article today suggesting that the FSB and the SVR and other Russian agencies are in the United Kingdom in great quantity, much more so than even in the Cold War. And so can you toss some of those agents out of the country? From the British perspective, that means there'll be retaliation and their agents will be tossed from Russia. So, I mean, there's going to be a cost-benefit analysis.
Yeah,
but there are steps that can be taken, right?
Right.
And you can declare diplomats persona non grata. And once you've done that, within 2 weeks, you can put them in, you can charge them and make them amenable to prosecution because they're no longer entitled to diplomatic immunities. And so they're expected to leave the country within those 2 weeks. You can declare them persona non grata. That's completely valid as a matter of international law. So there are these measures that the British could take, all of which, though, is part of this conversation about either measures that don't implicate international law and therefore are available to the British or are would otherwise violate international law but are countermeasures. None of that takes us to whether the British can plausibly use force in self-defense here, because I don't think they can. I don't think we're there yet.
I don't think they want. Yeah.
And so one of the conversations I saw when you talked about the NATO treaty, I thought we'd go right away to Article 5.
No.
Because I did see people talking about Article 5.
Yes.
Article 5 depends on there being an armed attack.
Yes.
And we've already talked about whether there can conceivably be an armed attack in these circumstances, and I really am doubtful of that.
Whereas Article 4 is a much lower threshold, is territorial integrity, political independence, and security.
Right.
So it's I think, you know, it's there. But, you know, it's really, we're in such an odd time right now, but like with, this is such a brazen attack. And I mean,
not attack.
But well, I mean, attack in a domestic, like as an attack on a person, not arms attack.
Right.
But the, when you have this kind of behavior, you know, you really do have to think creatively about the kinds of responses that you have. But, you know, even we talk about Canada being small, but even a state like Britain is going to be hard. It's going to be hard for them to kind of come up with a meaningful response without their allies.
Right.
So.
Yeah. So we'll watch this case going forward. And it'll be very interesting to see what happens going forward. And to the extent to which the British manage alliance relationships and there's a collective response. I haven't seen anything come out of the government of Canada yet on this case.
No. And like I said, it's fast moving. We're recording this on a Tuesday afternoon. Like I said, the deadline for Russia to actually give a response was tonight. So that'll be about 7 o'clock Canadian time. But the Russians, as far as I'm aware, the breaking news was that they just said they're not going to respond either way. Like, as you said, Theresa May asked them, was this a case of you lost control of your weapons or did you actually order this attack? Because we know this weapon came from you. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I think the trolling from the Russian Twitter accounts is obscene and just not helpful for any of this. And it just shows a certain level of immaturity that and also to a certain extent shows motive, you know, when the Brits came out and said that this was an attack in Britain of a Russian spy, they said, nope, it was an MI6 spy,
right.
Which is cheeky. But I mean, at the same time, it's like basically you're. There doesn't seem to be a lot of effort to deny.
Lots of conspiracy theories now floating around the internet. So the British chemical weapons research facility at Portendown is not far away from Salisbury, and so you can find on the internet conspiracy that it was actually a false flag. The British were responsible, etc. Right. So all this nonsense that's been floating around. So I think that's all the time we have for this special podcast on this issue.
And it's a fascinating topic. I'm glad we took the time to look at it, and maybe we'll have updates soon.
And tomorrow we'll post our sort of more regular podcast so that we can catch up on some developments in Canada as well. But thanks everyone for listening, and we will post our second podcast tomorrow.
Have a good one.